Good evening, and welcome to the Bonafide Moto Show. I'm your host, Joe Fleming, also known as So Tall Right Now. It's good to be back on the show, having a few days off. Having the show on Monday was quite weird, but it's okay. It's nice to have some prep time and only have one show a week. We've actually got shows scheduled out till mid-June now, which is quite crazy. So thank you all for joining us. I don't know why I'm smiling so much, but anyway, we can still hear the Vuvuzelas playing at 7 p.m. here every night, which is a nice feeling. It's nice to hear it every once in a while. The show is made possible by our friends at Motul. If you didn't see the little video posted just before the show on my personal profile, and I think we also shared it on the Bonafide Moto Co. I've got this like office chair, and I guess I sit in it too much, and it's quite squeaky. And I've sprayed Q20 on it previously, but now it got some of the Motul Easy Lube, and I sprayed a little bit. Works just fine. So hopefully it won't squeak for another few weeks. So that's a good thing. So tonight we've got a special guest who is a fellow South African, Mikness Olivier. I believe it's an Afrikaans name, so I may have messed up that last name. But him and his wife have been traveling around the world for about 10 years on their motorcycles. And I actually met him briefly at the DGR last year. He was a really funny guy. And our friend Matt, who was on the show a few weeks back, he met him on his around the world travels. And he said he's a really funny guy. And him and I had a few laughs earlier in the week. So I'm sure he's going to entertain us quite a lot. He is very knowledgeable with the world, with motorcycles, with gear. The blog and the webpage that they have is Peaky Peaky Overland. You can search his profile on our Instagram profile and find their website. They've got a lot of blog articles about various gear, galleries of where they've been. And it should be quite informative and also quite fun. I've got some really random questions that Matt Snaiman has helped me out with, outside of the normal travel questions. So it should be quite fun. He is currently in Bolivia on lockdown. He's been there for about 9-10 weeks, I think. But we'll let him chat about where he is at the moment. So without further ado, Mikness, I'm coming for you, buddy. Friend request or request through. My window's open. How's it? Waiting for Peaky Peaky. We did just hey, how's it?
Right, Newman.
Yeah, good. I'm glad we did that little test just before this call.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's strange that even in Bolivia and Sucre, in this small it's not a small town, but the Wi-Fi is surprisingly well here. It's quite good.
Yeah. That's good. I mean, that's the one thing that you kind of hope for when you're traveling, is that you'll have good Wi-Fi, and when you do, it's a good thing.
Yeah. So we actually connected now. I'm just trying to make sure that I'm not.
Yeah, we're good. We're good.
Well, we're good. Okay.
Yeah,
cool.
We're live.
Okay. No. So
you can say whatever you want. We can't take it back.
all the wrong things.
Yeah, we can't cut. We can't go back and change things.
Well, cheers to that.
Yeah. So Mikness, what beer have you got there?
This is Juari. It's Juari. A Bolivian beer. Yeah, it's a Juari. It's really good. It's brewed in Oruro, I think. And it's not the highest brewed beer in the world. I tried to check up. Apparently, there's another one that is in Bolivia. But it's not Huari, but it's a good beer. It's a
oh, cool. And is it like a is it like a like a lager?
Pilsner, a bit of a honey thing. The water is local. The honey that they use is local.
Oh, cool.
No, I must admit the local mainstream beers that we've tasted all around is really good stuff. I mean, it's drinkable.
where is the where's the shittiest beer that you've had, like a local beer of a place? Can you recall?
Americans are gonna kill me, but it's in America.
Which one? No, which one? I want to know.
But Budweiser is about the worst that I've
shit.
Ever had. About.
No, that's terrible. Yeah. That's tough.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, America, but we have to say that they've also got Americans got some really. But don't get me started on American beer. I'm so angry at Americans. It's their fault that we're paying $13 for a bloody beer.
Yeah.
No, it's wrong.
Matt, look, Matt did tell me that if I want to get you talking, to just start talking about beer, and
Give
it away on a tangent. So.
Yeah. We'll finish an hour just on beer.
Okay.
Not that I'm even an expert on beer. I like it, but
well, you know, like traveling traveling around the world. I mean, wherever. Even not even around the world to like different cities. I always try to go into like a pub and try out their local beer. Like if anyone has a local beer, like you want to try it because you want to see what the locals are making and what like makes the city known for their beer. Like it's nice to try.
Yeah, and you know, there's places like in Mexico. We had to stay 2 months in Guadalajara because of Elsby's knee. And the lady took us around to some of the oldest pubs in Mexico, in Guadalajara, where they still have the boards. If you look at the pub, there's a board inside the door, because in the old times, women and kids were not supposed to see what's going on inside the bar.
Oh, okay.
So, and this is like really old stuff. And the people there, man, it's beautiful to go into those old little pubs and grubby places that's been there for hundreds of years, and they still sell beer and they still do their thing. And there's three tenors that just old men that just stands up next moment they start to sing some classic stuff. Man, it's beautiful stuff. It's
That's
really
cool. Yeah, there's something about like an old school pub that when you walk in, like you respect the place. You've got a respect for the people who have been there before you, the stories that have been told, and the many pints that have been downed.
Good friendships and
so I want to find out about you and about Peaky Peaky, and I think the first question I have is what is Peaky Peaky stand for, and where did that come up with?
Peaky Peaky is a Swahili word for small motorcycle.
Oh.
And we our first intention when we started traveling wasn't to do the world or anything. It was just to get through Africa, just to get up in Africa, just to get into Europe. So we didn't. And it was just for fun because you know we knew a lot of overlanders, and you choose a name and make a sticker. It's all for fun. It's nothing. There's nothing serious about it. And we sat around and looked for names and just to be something fun and eventually. A friend of us that has also been from Africa said, well, Piki Piki is a small word for motorcycle. Oh, well, okay, then that's that. Cool. That's where it stayed. Yeah. So,
So you and Elsby, and it was what, like 9-10 years ago that you guys decided to start traveling through Africa, and kind of where did that take you?
Well, the idea was just to get through Africa because, I mean, South Africa sitting on the arse end of the world. I mean, where do you go? You go upward. So, yeah. So, and that was, and because of Africa. So we wanted to do that. And it's the cheapest way of starting off. You get on your bike, you just start riding upward. So that's the idea. And the idea was to get into 6 months through Africa into Europe and then park the bikes and then decide whatever the hell we want to do after. That never happened because it was such an eye-opener that by the time we got into Ethiopia, the 6 months was gone. And so we parked the bikes and flew back home, and it was, well, you had to go back because the bikes was in Ethiopia. So it the whole idea then started to grow here, but damn, this is nice. And being back home was bad, man. It's really when you come back home after 6 months, like, yes, I don't want to be here. This is not fun. It's much nicer fun sitting, drinking beer, some of the old guys somewhere in the mountains, and sitting back home working. And it just everything that we did eventually started to plan out that we need to do that more than it was a good decision, I think.
Yeah.
In the end.
So you guys had planned to go up through Africa for 6 months, and then what? You guys just took your time and enjoyed the days too much and just decided to kind of take your time and see how far you could get.
Yeah, you know, you get into a place and you don't want to spend 2 days there, and you see nothing, you do nothing, you run around, you, like in Lalibela, we were supposed to stay there, I think, 3 days. Eventually we stayed 2 weeks. There's just too much to see and too much stuff that you have to talk to people about. And then you end up in a place like Addis Ababa and you meet up 5 or 6 other overlanders, and you start doing stuff with them, and there's Boof a month going, month is gone. And, you know, and we've met up with a lot of our friends in Malawi in that December at the Cape Maclear, and that was a month and a half gone. You know, so, and then we planned again, and it took us 3 months just to get into Israel. And then it took us another 3 months to get into Europe. And then we were supposed to do a portion of Europe in 3 months because of the Schengen visa. But we spent a month just in Portugal. We was also supposed to be only a week. But how the hell do you do Portugal in a week? It's impossible. The place has got so much to see and drink and port and beaches and stuff. It's just no way you can do Portugal in a week. It's impossible.
Yeah. I've heard so many good things about Portugal. It looks to be like an amazing place.
Absolutely. Yeah. The people are amazing. Really, really friendly people. Yeah. They will invite you for anything.
my wife's family is Portuguese, so we've got to go at some point.
You have to. Really, yeah. Portugal is an amazing place. And I really love the people. We got invited, man, from nothing. Just, oh, no, you cannot. No, you cannot go stay in a campsite. No, you have to stay with us too.
And I've heard, you know, we've had a few people on the show so far who have, I think Matt was one of them, Charlotte, people who had traveled around the world like yourself. And the one thing that they said was that if someone's, obviously you're able to decide and like make a good judgment call, but if someone says, no, don't stay there, stay at my place, you take them up on that offer. The chance that you're in for a treat and that they really want to host you. They really want to look after you and show you a good experience. And have you had a similar experience with that?
Oh, every single time. People are really, the kindness of strangers is just, it blows your mind. It really, they invite you. There's no, we haven't had one guy that invited us for some, you know, funny, you have to stay there and then pay for, no, nothing. It just, honestly, I mean, the people we're staying now, Frank invited us. I've never met him. I've never met Rojan. We've only spoken a few times over the phone. I've got on Facebook. He said, please come stay with us if you're in Sucre. The lockdown happened. We ended in Sucre. It's 10 weeks later. We're staying with them in the house. I mean, how do you pitch up at people's place? You know them from nowhere and you stay 10 weeks in the house.
I give a lot of credit to that guy who invited you over. And to stay at his house, because when you mentioned that to me the other day, I was like, man, if someone wanted to stay here in my house for 10 weeks, I'd tell them to fuck off. but also, like, my house is quite small. We've got 3 dogs, 2 cats, there's 3 humans in here. You know, if we had a bigger house and more property, you know, I would love to be able to host someone on a regular basis like that. But it sounds like at least where you are, there was a kind person who is willing to open up their doors for you and let you stay for such a long time, because it could have been a tougher situation, like we spoke the other day, that you guys could have ended up finding a hostel to stay in for 10 weeks.
Look, and we have we're grown up, so we are some, all right, you know, if you guys need your space, we're happy to leave. I mean, she will help us with a hotel. We all do our bit. We pay our way. We pay them, for example, as if we're staying in a hotel. We buy them. So we really try and make it as normal as possible. And You know, we give each other space. It's a big property. There's seven dogs, really nice, cool dogs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, street
That's
dogs.
cool.
Roxana is street dog crazy. So she, if it's a street dog, and she helps him. So
Oh,
they
that's
all
cool.
got to put this whole family dog thing going. Yeah, it works out. Yeah, it's strange, but it
Yeah.
works.
And Meknes, I think what I'm so curious about is how did you guys start funding your trips in the beginning? And you know, now that you guys have been on the road for so long, how have you been able to make that possible?
So right in the beginning, I mean, we don't have kids. It was a choice thing. We didn't want to have kids, and it made life a little bit easier. So there are people that are traveling with kids. I don't have. I cannot. I will not be able to do that. It's not in my thing to do that. So that helped a little bit. We never went on big holidays and all this kind of stuff. But it's also in your mind, because you have to work. You have to do that. You know, you get into this, when you get out of school, you have to study, then you have to work, and this is how it's going to run, and at 50, 55, you retire, and all those kind of things. But you sort of have to get, and even when we started our first 6 months, we were like, how the hell are we going to fund 6 months being away from the work? Luckily, we bought property a long time ago. We worked really hard to get it paid off and make it as a passive income. So we could sort of started to get out of the norm. I've never worked for a salary. I've always worked in as a commissioner. So it was a little bit, the mindset was already there, but we saved a hell of a lot of money for the first 6 months. And it was like, yes, things can go horribly wrong.
Yeah.
But then the moment you get into it, it's like, okay, it's possible. It can happen. And you go back home and you start to like, do I really need a new iPhone? No, I can maybe buy a $200 thing. I don't need to have about an $800 thing. And do I really need a new car? No, you don't need a new car. You can go buy a damn second-hand car and save up the money for the rest. And so our mindset just really changed a lot. Like, you do not need the stuff that you think you need. And get rid of so we started to scale down a lot. We made sure that the properties, luckily, to Wi-Fi and internet, change the world of travel, because now else we can sit now and do work with people in South Africa. I can do products. I'm sitting in Sucre. I'm talking to people in America and Europe and do business still in South Africa. So it made traveling a lot easier now. I mean, 10 years ago when we started, there was no iOverland. Facebook's just started. Instagram didn't exist. The reason we started the blog was people asked us, hey man, tell me about the border post. Now, how did you guys do border post? So I write a little bit. You can't do that on Facebook. So that's actually the reason why we started the blog, and things just get from
yeah.
But the moment you get out of the, and there's people traveling with kids. For me, that's hardcore stuff. But they do it. They survive. They teach them on the road. They get a good experience. And the people that we've met with kids, those kids are really well adjusted. They make friends quickly. They talk a lot of languages. So it's actually a good thing, and it opened up. I think the whole travel thing has opened up a lot, and they can do online courses. I mean, we're doing Spanish courses now online with a lady.
Oh, cool!
Because we can't go visit them.
No, so, it's amazing.
But yeah, I think
you can.
The plan just came from a long time. It wasn't we decided yesterday we were born rich. We're not rich at all, at any imagination. It's just that you have to, there's a lot of sacrifices you have to make to do this.
Yeah, and I think that's a different way of looking at it, is that I guess some people, you know, assume that it takes a lot of money to travel the world, but it also really takes a lot of sacrifice in terms of kind of cutting out the things you don't necessarily need in your life. And like Al said, is that you're rich in experiences. And that's definitely the case, is that you may not have a big house with tons of shit in your garage. You're traveling around on a motorcycle. You're experiencing the world and amazing people from all around. And each day is different. And each day is a different scenery. And in regards to scenery, I noticed actually when I was trying to get photos for the show, I looked closely in all the photos, and I think I found like one or two photos of you on Instagram, and the rest are of your wife. So that leads me to believe that you're the photographer, And you're a damn good photographer at that as well.
I've got a face for radio. I don't have a face for TV or photos.
Nice.
Yeah. No. Yeah, and even the radio is bad.
So tell me what camera do you shoot with? What sort of I see as well that you shoot while riding, and
yeah.
A lot of the photos I've seen, like you, I'm just so curious. Like, do you take your time to set up? Is there a lens that you have in particular that's always on the camera as your go-to? Tell me about your camera setup.
Currently, I'm using a Fuji X-T3. Mm. I've got three lenses with me, an 18 135, which is a go-to lens.
Yeah.
It's a really nice, it's weather sealed. It's a really nice overall usable travel lens. I won't use anything else for if I have to choose one lens. I've got a 10-24 for landscapes.
Okay.
I don't use that often because the damn thing is not weather sealed. So the moment you zoom in and out in a place like Laguna's, boof, there's dust in the damn thing. So
yeah.
I didn't use that often. And I've got a 35 F2 prime for festivals, late night, all those kind of stuff. Because the 18-135 is not made for that kind of stuff.
This one. I think that's
the one.
The 35.
Beautiful lens.
That's my go-to.
That's the go-to excellent. One, yeah. That's a beautiful lens. And it's sharp, it works, it's small, but it's at festivals, man, that thing is just, and it's yeah. lightning quick to focus. It's a beautiful thing, yeah. So the Fuji, the mirrorless, I love them. They're small enough in the hand. They give a good presence that you're not just a tourist point and shoot type of thing, but it's not a DSLR. I've seen guys at festivals with DSLRs, man. Good luck to them. I don't want to hold that stuff around.
Yeah. And mirrorless hasn't been around that long, and you've been traveling for 9 years. So what were you shooting before the X-T4?
I started off with a Nikon P7000, which is the highest point and shoot waterproof professional little camera thing. It had a small little zoom. Beautiful thing. Raw footage. Raw, man, that thing is beautiful. But it started to get limitations because if you shoot one genre, let's say you do portraits, it's fine to have a camera with just that, and you can do that. But now you get up in the morning, there's landscapes, there's actions, there's the afternoon sun. Then you want to go do a landscape in the evening, and maybe you get, so you have to do such a variety of shooting during the day that little compact just didn't work for me anymore. And it was a really nice thing because it was small, quickly in the pocket.
For sure.
Weather sealed, beautiful little thing. Yeah. And then I could never get to this DSLR things. Man, carrying a thing like this, like a brick,
it just
never worked for me. Yeah, and you have to have the lenses and all that stuff. So I didn't, when mirrorless came out of, the Nikon was actually a mirrorless in that sense because it doesn't that. But when the real mirrorless, the Samsung NX1, that was the first one of the lot that really changed the game. And in Samsung, in their stupidity, stopped making them not 2 years later. It was an amazing camera. And I did some homework, and I've got friends with Fuji, and they're like, buy Fuji. I said, I'm not a hipster. I don't buy Fuji. Get it out of your mind. I don't do that nonsense. And watch their photos, watch their stuff. And Fuji, for example, the warranties and the way they look after people. Man, that's amazing. And for me, that counts more than the product. Because Canon and Nikon, for example, in South Africa, if you buy it in South Africa, don't think you're going to fix that outside of the place. It ain't going to happen. If you buy a Nikon or a Canon in America, you take it back home, it breaks, sorry, it's your problem. They will not fix a thing. Fuji, for example, gives a 2-year around the world warranty. That, for me, is what I need to have. That. Because like in Chile, if you have a bit of a problem, there's a Fuji there. I can go there. They will look after me. I know it. Fuji South Africa. I bought my X-T2 in Colombia. Something went wrong with the sensor. Nothing bad. Nothing serious. I went to Fuji South Africa. They replaced me with X-T3. I mean, flip it. That's the kind of stuff I need. Oh. I cannot do. Yeah. Yeah. So I will stick to them for now. It's a good brand. They can get their lenses. And I like their photos. They produce some really good good stuff.
Yeah, I think I've been shooting with Fuji now for, I'd say, almost 4 years. And we've got a Sony A7 that Alan uses for film. And we've been on a couple trips where I've tried to use that for stills photography if I'm shooting video. And it's something with the trigger. Like, I know when I squeeze the trigger on the Fuji, when I'm going to get that shot. I know exactly the moment. I know everything. I can feel it. But it was something when I tried that Sony, it was like a delay, something. I mean, it takes beautiful photos, but I just, I didn't have the confidence in it. But I mean, I've also been shooting on the same, I've been shooting X-T2. I used the X-T1 for about a year, and then I've been on the X-T2 now for about 3 years. And
it's a beautiful camera.
Solid.
Yeah. It's like bikes, you know, you can buy a new bike and you get all the fancy like the X-T4s, but then there's the X-T2 that it still works good. It still gives you bloody good photos. You know,
I got no problems.
No, exactly. I've actually begged Fuji if they can't sell me back the old one. They don't want to do that.
Yeah, my this one I've got is a refurb. The one that I had previously was, man, it was banged up. It was scratched. It had been dropped from the motorcycle. It looked like hell, and I was like, please, can I just like keep it and like put it on my wall or something? Like, it needed to be like a piece of art. I mean, they take a beating, and I'm very tough on cameras. I don't put it in a case. I don't have a lens cover for everything. I sling it around me when I'm riding. They get beat to hell, and I have no problem.
Well, it's the same with me. I don't have fancy cases for the camera. It lives in my tank bag, right in front of my balls. I have a little neoprene case that Elsby made for me that I use a hand strap, and then I put it over my hand, and I just keep it in my hand when we walk. I don't abuse it. I mean, I really look at as good as I can for it. But like when we were at the Dakar rally, that camera was for 2 days in the dust, every day shooting constantly. You must have seen what that thing looked like. And so it's pretty amazing what damage they can abuse they can handle.
And Mignus, so you've been traveling for 9, 10 years on the road. How have you evolved as a rider from when you sort of began? Like, were you on like a GS when you guys started? What have you learned kind of along the way to make you a better traveler, I guess?
Well, first of all, you don't want fancy. Look, it's nice having all the fancy stuff and fancy screens and all this kind of stuff, but eventually the damn thing will give you problems. At some stage, it's going to give you problems. So you sort of tend to eventually, over time, move to simpler stuff that like, for example, the Dakar, the 650 Dakar that BMW built in end of 2006-2007, really beautiful bike. Solidly, you can do 240,000 Ks in the thing. Nice stuff, but it was a bit heavy. And then there's a fuel pump, and then there's a radiator and all this kind of stuff. And eventually we just, man, I had so much problems with this stuff. And if something breaks, it's not the part, the part on the fuel pump, the water pump is $100. To get the pump from South Africa into Sudan is $400 and 4 weeks worth of waiting. It's just, man, it's soul crushing. So you tend to move down. I love the BMs. I love the fancy bikes. And I have my HP2 back home, but there's no way I'm going to take the damn thing around the world. If the shaft breaks, it's $800 and 4 weeks waiting to get somebody to give it. So you tend to go lighter. You tend to go less complicated. Anything that's complicated must go. I have no... Yeah. For small little things, we use anything with a USB charger because I have one USB charger. I don't carry, if it's penlight batteries and it's got to be recharged, I'm not going to buy it. If it's a camera with rechargeable batteries, get out of my life. I don't want you because it's another charger I need to carry, another damn thing. So if it, like the XT2, I can charge the XT2 through a normal USB socket. Done.
Yeah.
I don't have to carry the thing. So everything that we do, you try and tend to go lighter, easier, less complicated all the time, which also helps because now you can donor into places where you normally won't take a big GS or a KTM or one of those kind of bikes. Because you want to go into places that you know, you have to. Now the Lagunas route, we had to drag the two bikes out of two rivers. There's no way I would have dragged a 230-kilogram monster out of that. I would have left it there walk.
Yeah, you posted, there was a video, I think, you posted where you dropped a bike in the river. I think it was something about learning along the way. And you picked that thing right up. It didn't seem to be a problem. I was like, that's either you're very strong or the bike's quite light.
The water was bloody cold. My balls were getting. The water was cold, and I was scared my camera getting to the. Yeah, but that's the thing. You want to pick up a bike like this. You don't want to struggle. We've had places that you had to ride up into alleys to get to a door where the hostel. You park your bike inside the hostel because you can't leave it outside. Then we've got friends with 800 GSs. They first have to take all the luggage off. Then all four of us help them get this damn bike up into the thing, and then nee, dankie. No thanks. It's beautiful having them back. I mean, it's really nice having doing the trips in South Africa or around South Africa. Let's say you're in America or in Europe, and you want to do the trips there with them. Beautiful. Use them for that, but no.
Magnus, I'm curious of some of your stories from your travels. Is there a particular campfire story that you share with like new friends when you meet them? Is there like a couple stories that like you really enjoy telling?
Oh man, there's a lot. It depends on what you want to hear. Real bad stuff or real good stuff?
I mean, it's kind of like non-censored on here, but I mean, do what you want, that thing.
Yeah. No, there's good stories and there's struggle stories. I don't tend to tell the really bad struggle stories because I don't want to make it sound like you know you're just Chuck Norris trying to do some stuff. So there's always some.
So tell us a good one. Tell us a good one.
Okay, a good one. A good one was in Sudan, for example. We the Dakar broke. It's 50 degrees outside in Khartoum. We have to drive around because we were looking for something, and I was pillioning LCV, and the fuel pump, the water pump broke again. And it was this thing where I can go 2 kilometers. I have to switch the bike off, go 2 kilometers, switch the bike off, and eventually we ended up at a small restaurant. And it was a Sudanese guy, but I was just not in the mood anymore. I was like, man, today we leave these bikes and fly back. I'm sick of them now. And especially in Khartoum, it's 50 degrees. It's dry heat. It's just not, and there's no beer. You cannot drink in Saudi Arabia. In Sudan. So this guy's sitting there and he's like, let me help you guys. Let me help you. Let me take you back to the. So we sort of, and on our way back to the camp, he says, no, let go to my house. You come eat with me. Man, I can't do that. Okay, we're following. Now we're following him, and it looks like this typical Iran movies where they went to go fetch Bin Laden out of a compound type thing. We're moving into this kind of thing.
I have issues with that.
This is not good. So we're sitting there, and we're going with him, and we're moving to this compound, and takes us to the third floor, and his wife comes out and his kids, and it's a greeting thing, but it's very, very nice. It's respectful and all those kind of things. Now we have to go to his other friend's compound. I'm like, dude, I need to get somehow to Wi-Fi at some stage, or not even Wi-Fi, because at that stage you can only buy the little SIM cards for the phones, and then you upload and. No, go to his friends. We go to another friend of his compound. The same kind of thing. I swear it looks like this Bin Laden thing. Now we're going to fetch from the river. And then, so now we're going into the basement. I said to LCB, you know that stories when your friends get back home in the news about the people, the stupid tourists that's got kidnapped and it's for ransom and then they get killed and their bodies get dumped in the Nile? This tonight is that.
This feels right.
There's just, I something is not right here. The next moment, three other guys pitch up. all in white robes and the stuff, and but they speak perfect English. And the one guy brings a guitar out and he starts, and I'm like, no, he's a musician in Sudan. Okay. And the other guy, he's got a big belly, and he introduced himself that he's the cigarette or marketing manager of the cigarette company in Sudan. And the other guy was there. I don't remember what was he doing. And so we're sitting, and they are chatting. So it eases up a little bit that, okay, it might not be that bad. But the evening's not over yet. So we'll check this stuff. Oh, the other guy was a professor or something. So he started chatting about religion. I said, oh, man, it's the last thing I want to chat about. But he says, no, I'm actually an atheist. Oh, really? You're an atheist in Sudan at a university. Damn, that must be hardcore. And he tells us stories about really bad stuff, how, man, you cannot even mention the word atheist in Sudan, type thing. And the guy with the cigarette factory, with the belly, I said to him, man, you guys eat well here. It's either that or you drink beer. No beer. 13 lashes if they catch you with a beer in Sudan. 13 lashes. Ain't gonna work here. He says, but I can get you some other stuff. Well, get what you want. So the one guy leaves, he comes back with two Coke bottles, empty, not empty, Coke, normal Coke bottles, but it's got white spirits in it. He says, this is date wine. Really? So now he starts passing this date wine, but man, this is bad stuff. This is really, really bad. So I said, so we start chatting. I said, but you guys are not allowed to drink. No, but everybody drinks in Sudan. Oh, but you're getting lashes for it. Yes, but nobody knows about it. So it was a beautiful evening, and it eventually turned out that they're really nice guys, and they helped us back home, and they helped us into new place that we had to stay. But it's just that you get into a place where you feel, man, things can now really get seriously bad. And in hindsight, it was a bad decision. It was really, we weren't supposed to do that. We were still really noobs. We couldn't judge anything about people or anything. So it was a bad call from our side. But luckily, it didn't turn out that bad. So, yeah. But I've learned a few things. They actually still do drink in Sudan.
Yeah.
And there are other religions
Where there's a will, there's a way.
When there's a will, there's a way. If you
Yeah.
ban booze, it's going to pop up somewhere again.
Yeah, for
But yeah,
sure.
this, you know. Okay,
And
stuff like South America, I love the place because of that. The people are really easygoing. And Mexico, I went into rodeo rings where I just shot. People invite me into the ring while they were there. In Arequipa, I went into a rodeo ring in the ring while they were still there. It's just don't kill yourself. You know, so there's really nice stuff and nice stuff happening if you put yourself out there
Yeah,
to go
for
do the
sure.
things. You know? Yeah.
And I think that's it kind of goes back to what we spoke about in the beginning of the show, is sort of taking time to enjoy a town, or like to stay
Yeah.
somewhere longer than just a day or two, because then you're able to walk around the market, speak to the locals, ask them what's going on that evening, and really kind of feel the pulse of that city. Otherwise, you know, if you don't have a lot of time to spend, you're only going to see just a few things and not really get the full-on experience of the
That is
place.
very true. And I mean, a lot of cities are really rubbish. I mean, surely, there's just no two ways about it. But you get beautiful cities and beautiful places that actually warrant. And this is the other thing that photography helped me with, is that the moment you get into people's faces and you ask them, you know, can I take a photo, can I this, you sort of, you invade this space, and some allow it and some don't. But most of the times, people take you in and they show you stuff. And you never get that experience in a, I mean, in cities what's up, Valparaiso in Chile. It's a beautiful little, not little, but it's gritty, and it's, but the artists have painted the buildings and stuff. Now a lot of other artists move in, and they love Pink Floyd. For some reason, everybody there loves Pink Floyd. They've even got the tattoos that says Pink Floyd. So you cannot get into them and start chatting to them with 2 days in that city. It's impossible. We were there most probably a week, in just walking around that city, getting to people. And I got the most beautiful photos and the most beautiful people that we spoke to, and artists, and what they're there and why, and all this kind of stuff, just by being there a little bit longer than the normal running around type of stuff is.
I think being able to get like great quality photos especially when it comes to like people, is about the relationship that you build with those people. I think if you're able to kind of get someone on your side and get to know someone, they're able to show you a little bit more of them, of themselves even, and of that area that you want to look at, and they'll take you to the good spots as well.
Oh yes, yeah, and it's nice, you know. People are actually funny. With the moment you ask them, or you in their face, you ask them, you know, can I take a photo of you? When they say no, then you know you take your. But when they say yes, they actually allow you much more than just to take the photo. They allow you to talk to them, to ask them questions. So, in that way, I think for me, it made travel a lot more rewarding and engaging and getting into. Otherwise, I would have never. I mean, you walk past somebody, you won't take your cell phone out and take a photo of them. You're not going to do that. And you're not going to have that relationship or the thing with them. And most of the times I ask people, can I send you the photo? And
yes. Then
you have a Facebook connection of them or something that you keep in contact. So there's a lot of the people that we still have contact with just because of that.
Yeah, that was those two things are practices that I did in India. One was asking people every time before I take their photo, like, can I take your photo? And I would hold the camera up and they say yes. I think I maybe only had like one person say no. If I could, I would always ask them, like, are you on Instagram? Most of the people I asked were on Instagram, or I would send them send it to the WhatsApp. And it's just so nice because you took the photo and now it's yours. You can at least share it with them as well.
And they appreciate it. Yeah, small town in Bolivia, we came in. The second night there was a festival. I didn't even know that it was a Padre or Madre festival. There were kids in the streets spraying themselves with a party foam. It was one big kid party in the middle of the street with all this other stuff. And people were taking photos. I was taking photos of kids and everything. And every time when I see maybe the mom or dad is close, I'll go, awesome, can I send you the photo? And I'm like, yeah, sure. You know, you want to take more kids photos of the kids? No, thanks. One is enough. But it's amazing how quickly you connect with that kind of stuff.
My buddy Lowry just commented here. He said, being fed by the locals is also a beautiful thing. And we rode out to this like private beach. Someone guided us there and there was no one there. It was really small. We get out to the island and then 2 minutes later, this guy rolls up on a moped and he's got a bowl in his mouth and he's riding up to us. And he's like, hey, hello. And he has this prawn curry that is in this bowl. And he's like, hello. And he's like, here, try some. I'm like, whoa, no, I don't eat prawns. Because in India, people said, like, be careful of the prawns. I mean, this dude just rocked up from the forest. There's no way I'm going to try it. But the other guys did. And then they're all like, oh, it's so good. And so I ended up trying it. But at one point, he was standing underneath this palm tree. And he was like this. And it was a great moment. And I said, hey, please, can I take your photo? And he said, yes. And then he said, wait. And he grabbed the bowl of prawn curries and he put it right in my mouth. And I was like, son of a bitch. Like, okay, cool. I'll eat the prawn curry because it's a great photo. It was worth it. It was worth it.
That kind of stuff happens a lot, and I love it, man. Because you really get part of the whole process. It's got to happen. You cannot be a part from the process of being in a country or travel or whatever the case. You've got to. If they feed you, you've got to eat them. So you can ask. I see Avida is on Susie and Kelvin. We've been with them to festivals.
Okay.
And we take photos. We're in the street. People will come up, they mix their own booze. They take everything they've got at home that's old, half empty. They put it into a bottle, add spirits, add gasoline, add anything to it to give it more kick, a battery, a AAA battery for zinc. And then as they go in the parade, they feed everybody. They have to take shots from that stuff. We've had been places where we were drunk just because of people feeding us. And you have to drink it out of a bottle. You can't say to them, no, suck it up, baby. You got to get this. No, that's good
Yeah, I
stuff.
did love it. And I saw Elsie B said something about your t-shirt. Do you have something written on your t-shirt?
Ooh, this one.
Wow, there
This
you
is
go.
my, yeah,
National
this is the
Pornographic.
that's my license. So Marina, good friend of us, South Africa, she and her husband, they actually did photography for National Geographic. It's a big
Again.
thing. So I
Yeah.
said to her, give me the damn National Geographic badge. I want to fake it and make a thing. It says I'm a, what do you call it, a magazine photographer, because it's easy to get into
Yeah.
places like that.
It's
And
so
I thought, well,
true.
man, no, this is going to get me into trouble. I mean, sure, I'm sure National Geographic won't take likes from that nonsense. So I thought, well, I need to do something else. So I designed this t-shirt that says National Pornographic. So when you walk up to people, the first thing they do is like, oh, National Geographic photographer, no problem. I will pose for National Geographic. Which, yeah, but then they start seeing that it's not the same thing. So they start smiling. And actually what happens is that, man, it's good fun. The moment they start smiling, I start snapping. And you get some really good photos, and they come to me and they make jokes and all this kind of stuff. So this t-shirt's actually done a lot, and especially at festivals where you go to serious events, it sort of breaks the mood and break the stuff to for people to take photos with this stuff.
Yeah,
So
I think humor and a smile can be exchanged as a form of bribery. And it basically means if you're not an asshole or don't be a dick, someone's willing to help you out. If
Oh,
they
for
see
sure.
that you're trying to, like if you're a nice guy, like people are willing to help. But if you're an asshole, no, sorry.
No, now you're
Don't
out of
come here with
there.
that t-shirt.
No, for sure. And that's the other thing, is you get into places where I steal a lot of photos, because I want to take photos of people like the way they are at that specific moment. The moment you ask them for a photo, their face changes. So I steal a lot of
Yes,
photos.
that's me.
But the moment I do that, I look up, I look in the eyes, I see if I can find contact, I smile, I show them a thumbs up, all these kind of things. You can immediately see if it's sort of okay of stuff. But if you smile and you always, you do it like this. I've had only good experiences. I've never had bad experiences with people that, okay, the police might be a bit different, but that's something.
We had this and when we went to India, my main goal was to make sure, well, I brought my open face because I wanted to be able to greet people and smile and everything's cool. And we the first time it worked out in our favor was that we're riding through this forest, we're a bit lost, or we're changing our place where we're gonna stay. Roll up on this intersection, there's these three guys who are drunk, and we ask them for directions. And the one guy's like, I can see he looks a bit agitated, irritated at us, and he comes up to me and he's like, who are you? And I was like, I'm Joe, who are you? And he just broke the ice, done. Like, that was it. And I guess if I would have had a full face, I wouldn't have been able to have that experience with him. And it really, like, the more you kind of show that, like, everything's cool, even if you exaggerate it, I think it goes a long way, to establish a connection with those people. And it'll get you some help for sure.
No, for sure. Getting angry and getting agitated is 99% of the time the wrong approach to take. And I've done that, and I've got my hiding for it. So, being nice most of the times will work.
And Mykonos, is there a country or like a region that you guys have not been to that you want to go to?
Oh, well, the rest of the world. I mean, we were supposed to be going around the world. It takes us so damn slow. We're still in South America 4 years later. So, yes, the Balkans, Asia, that area, I really wanted to go do that. Still do that. Australia, still want to go see. South America has blown my mind. It is absolutely a, it is the people everywhere. There's gritty and there's good and there's bad and there's ups and there's mountains and there's seas, and it's really the only thing that South America doesn't have is Africa wildlife. Other than that, they've got everything. The squares, the people, the social ability about people. So, and even Central America, really, really nice. Canada, we haven't done Canada. I really do want to go do Canada. Iceland, I've seen so many photos. Four wheel nomad, Lisa and Jason, you must check his photos. Amazing stuff. And they were in Iceland. Oh, man. Yeah, no, there's so many stuff that we still need to go see. The world is a big place.
Yeah, it is. And is there something that you've learned about yourself while being on the road for this long? Is it like, have you grown as an individual? Have you changed in some ways?
Yeah, I think that for one, I got a lot more patience. I'm a very impatient person. I have to learn to live with that nonsense. But that you actually don't know nothing. You think you know something, you know nothing, and your curve starts all over again. But yes, and to you know that. Whatever you think is the norm, there's always other people with different norms than yours and different beliefs, and you have to like, man, it's difficult to I'm struggling to get my mind around trying to understand your point of view, but you have to then understand other point and that because they think differently, and it's not that they are wrong or you're wrong, it's just that's the way it goes, you know. So I had to that was one thing that opened my mind about everything a lot more. That before you judge people, try and understand why they say what, why they do this different stuff, why they believe in different stuff, because there's a reason for that. They didn't just be like that, you know. So, and that gave me a lot of patience to be more patient and accepting of what other people do, and don't just judge and you know. So yeah, I did learn a lot from myself, and the
I'm
other fact is
sure.
that you can actually do and deal with a lot more stuff than you think you can deal with. You know, so
Yeah.
whatever you think back home is you're dealing with stuff, you're not dealing with stuff. There's other people dealing with way worse stuff than what you think you're dealing with stuff. You know, so.
Like I always and like the example I take from what you just said is like a bike breaking down. I remember in the beginning whenever something would go wrong with my bike, I thought it was the end of the world. Like that was the feeling that I got in my chest, in my neck, like everywhere. And I'm like, what am I gonna do? Oh no. But the reality is that if you just stop, take a breath, and like just kind of check the situation out, like things will come right. It does happen for a reason,
Reason,
and you know, you're never too
you'll
far
see.
to get help. I mean, obviously there's
No,
certain
you'll figure
things.
stuff out.
Yeah, you will
Yeah,
figure it
you'll
out.
figure stuff out. Yeah, I mean, to Vidas now and again, they must one day tell you about the stuff they had problems with bikes. I mean, Calvin's bike literally fell apart in Chile. Like in, he couldn't ride the thing. Literally, the whole frame. They had to fix that. So. I mean, it's stuff that you deal with suddenly that you never at home maybe deal with stuff like that. I'm not talking about death and all this kind of stuff. I talk about stuff in your day. So it is actually quite a learning curve. I would actually think that if people can, especially young people, go travel a year or two, you know, you suddenly open your mind up to a lot more things that you would otherwise doing that.
Yeah, I think travel makes it's made me a better person, because I've been able to see other cultures and what it's like wherever I may have gone. I agree with you. I know a lot of people back home that they've never left their hometown. Like they don't travel, and it's a beautiful world, you know, to go see, and you grow and you learn to appreciate those places, and you want to maybe go back there someday, and then you actually maybe want to go to another country nearby there, and you want to keep going. And but I mean, I guess, you know, to each their own. You know, we're travelers. We want to travel and we want to see the world, and for other people they may not, but you know, hopefully soon after this we can keep on traveling and hit the road again.
Yeah, I mean, we've got one life. You live on a small rock in the middle of the universe, and I don't want to die one day and not say, at least try my best to see and experience as much as that's currently on this rock. So yeah,
Well
it's
said,
true.
Magnus. So we've got 2 minutes left, so I think it's a good point to kind of end. Yeah, the hour goes quick, eh? It amazes me. Like the first 15 minutes, sometimes I'm like, wow, this is good. You know, taking a while, and then next thing you know, I've got to cut it off.
It's gone. I've got another hour left of Spanish class. But here's a trick I can tell you guys. If you ever travel Spanish places, so what I've learned was this, and this is about the only thing I know in Spanish, to say no fumar español, but that means I don't smoke Spanish. Now, the moment the police or somebody stops you, you just say, oh, no fumar español, no fumar español. So he's either going to think you're a moron or he's going to kill you. But either way, it will sort it out quite quick.
Yeah. Well, I saw Elsevier said to speak Afrikaans to cops as well. So.
Oh, that helps. Oh, if you can speak any other language, then so this is what we do. Some places, a lot of people are not inclined for English speaking. I don't know why. For some reason, they just don't like it. So the moment you speak Afrikaans or Dutch or any other language, like, oh, foreigners. Okay, not the same people that English people. Yeah. It also helps. I've got no idea why. But, yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully I'll so we've got a minute and 20 seconds left. When are you coming back to South Africa? Do you know?
I've got no idea. Hopefully not soon, but now with the lockdowns ain't gonna happen in any case fast. So I've got no idea.
Well,
there's still a lot to see. Yeah.
Well we'll catch up soon. Thank you so much for being on the show, Magnus. I really appreciate it. It was great.
Yeah, thanks for
all
being
here,
Magnus.
Yeah. Really nice. And to everyone else, thank you so much for joining us again. It's going to be weird. The next show will only be in 1 week's time. But next week, we've got a really great show as well. We've got Gary O'Keefe from the Baikal Project, which these motorcyclists did a world record on the longest frozen lake in the world. It's ridiculous. I'll do a post tomorrow about it so you can catch us next Wednesday with Gary. It'll be an amazing story. Thank you all for joining. And Magnus, have a great
evening. Thank you, guys. Yeah, thanks everybody that listened to our nonsense.
Yeah, it was great, Magnus. Thanks so much.
Thanks, man. Okay. Ciao, ciao. See you guys again.
Okay. Ciao. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.